Before I have to answer, Lindsay makes a kind of hissing noise and juts her chin up, gesturing behind me. Psychopath alert. Lock up the knives and babies. Juliet Sykes has just walked into the cafeteria. I've been so focused on today, on fixing it, on the idea that I can fix it, I've totally forgotten about Juliet. But now I whip around, more curious about her than I've ever been. I watch her drifting through the cafeteria. Her hair is down and concealing her face, fuzzy, soft hair, so white it reminds me of snow. That's what she looks like, actually. Like a snowflake being buffeted around in the wind, twisting and turning on currents of air. She doesn't even glance up in our direction, and I wonder if even now she's planning it. Planning to follow us tonight and embarrass us in front of everybody. It doesn't seem like she would have it in her. I'm so focused on watching her that it takes me a second to realize Allie and Elodie have just finished a round of Psycho Killer, Qu'est-ce que c'est, and are now laughing hysterically. Lindsay's holding up her fingers crossed like she's warding off a curse, and she keeps repeating, "Oh Lord, keep the darkness away." "Why do you hate Juliet?" I ask Lindsay. It's strange to me that I've never thought of asking until recently. I always just accepted it. Elodie snorts and almost coughs up her Diet Coke. "Are you serious?" Lindsay's clearly not prepared for the question. She opens her mouth, closes it, and then tosses her hair and rolls her eyes like she can't believe I'm even asking. "I don't hate her." "Yes, you do." It was Lindsay who found out that Juliet wasn't sent a single rose freshman year, and Lindsay's idea to send her a valigram. It was Lindsay who nicknamed her Psycho and who, all those years ago, spread the story of Juliet peeing on the Girl Scout camping trip. Lindsay stares at me like I've lost my mind. "Sorry," she says, shrugging. "No breaks for mental health patients."
"Don't tell me you feel bad for her or something," Elodie says. "You know she should be locked up."
"Belle of you," Allie giggles. "I was just wondering," I say, stiffening when Allie says the B word. There's still always the possibility that I've gone totally, clinically cuckoo. But somehow I don't think so anymore. An article I once read said that crazy people don't worry about being crazy. That's the whole problem.
"So, are we really staying in tonight?" Allie says, pouting. "The whole night?"
I suck in my breath and look at Lindsay. Allie and Elodie look at her, too. She has final say on all of our major decisions. If she's hell-bent on going to Kent's, I'll have a hard time getting out of it. Lindsay leans back in her chair and stares at me. I see something flicker in her eyes and my heart stops, thinking that she'll tell me to suck it up, that a party will do me good. But instead, she cracks a smile and winks at me.
"It's just a party," she says. "It'll probably be lame anyways."
"We can rent a scary movie," Elodie pipes up. "You know, like we used to."
"It's up to Sam," Lindsay says. "Whatever she wants."
I could kiss her right then. I cut English with Lindsay again. We pass Alex and Anna in Hunan Kitchen, but today, Lindsay doesn't even pause, probably because she's trying extra hard to be nice to me and she knows I hate confrontations. I hesitate, though. I think of Bridget putting her arms around Alex and looking at him like he's the only guy on Earth. She's annoying, okay, but she deserves way better than him. It's too bad.
"Hello. Stalk much?" Lindsay says.
I realize I'm just standing there staring past the ripped-up flyers advertising $5 lunch specials and local theater groups and hair salons. Alex Lament has spotted me through the window. He's staring straight back at me. "I'm coming." "It's too bad, but really, what can you do? Live and let live." In the country's best yogurt, Lindsay and I both get heaping cups of double chocolate with crushed peanut butter cups, and I add sprinkles and Cap'n Crunch cereal. I have my appetite back, that's for sure,
Everything is working out the way I planned it. There won't be any party tonight, at least not for us. There won't be any driving or cars. I'm sure that this will fix everything. That the kink in time will be ironed out. That I'll wake up from whatever nightmare I've been living. Maybe I'll sit up gasping in a hospital bed somewhere, surrounded by friends and family. I can picture the scene perfectly. My mom and dad tearful, Izzy crying while she hangs on my neck, Lindsay and Allie and Elodie and... An image of Kent flashes through my head and I push it away quickly. And Rob. Of course, Rob. But this is the key, I'm sure of it. Live the day out. Follow the rules. Stay away from Kent's party. Simple.
Careful. Lindsay grins, shoveling a huge spoonful of yogurt into her mouth. You don't want to be fat and a virgin.
Better than fat with gonorrhea, I say, flicking a chocolate chip at her. She flicks one back.
Are you kidding? I am so clean, you could eat off me.
The Lindsay buffet. Does Patrick know you're giving it up like that?
Gross.
Lindsay's wrestling with her jumbo cup, trying to dig out the perfect bite. But we're both laughing and she ends up lobbing a full spoonful of yogurt at me. It hits me right above the left eye. She gasps and claps one hand over her mouth. The yogurt slides down my face and lands with a plop, right on the fur covering my left boob.
I'm so, so sorry,
Lindsay says, her voice muffled by her hand. Her eyes are wide and it's obvious she's trying not to laugh.
Do you think your shirt is ruined?
Not yet, I say, and dig out a big scoop of yogurt and flick it at her. It hits her in the side of her head, right in her hair. She shrieks, "Bitch!" And then we're ducking around the TCBY, hiding behind chairs and tables, digging big scoops of double chocolate and using our spoons like catapults to peg each other. You can't judge a gym teacher by his handlebar mustache. Lindsay and I can't stop cracking up on the way back to school. It's hard to explain, but I'm feeling happier than I have in years, like I'm noticing everything for the first time. The sharp smell of winter, the light strange and slanted, the way the clouds are drawing over the sky slowly. The fur of our tank tops is completely matted and gross, and we have water stains everywhere. Cars keep honking at us, and we wave and blow them all kisses. A black Mercedes rolls by, and Lindsay bends over, smacks her butt, and screams, $10, $10! I punch her in the arm. That could be my dad.
Sorry to break it to you, but your dad does not drive a Mercedes.
Lindsay pushes her hair out of her face. It's stringy and wet. We had to wash off in the bathroom as the woman at TCBY screamed at us and threatened to call the police if we ever stepped foot in the store again. You're impossible, I say.
You know you love me,
she says, grabbing my arm and huddling up next to me. We're both freezing. I do love you, I say, and I really mean it. I love her. I love the ugly mustard yellow bricks of Thomas Jefferson and the magenta tinted halls. I love Ridgeview for being small and boring, and I love everyone and everything in it. I love my life. I want my life.
Love you too, babes.
When we get back to school, Lindsay wants to have a cigarette, even though the bell for 8th is going to ring any second.
2 trags,
Lindsay says, widening her eyes, and I laugh and let her pull me along because she knows I can never say no to her when she makes that face. The lounge is empty. We stand right next to the tennis courts, huddled together while Lindsay tries to get a match lit. Finally, she does, and she takes a long drag, letting a plume of smoke out of her mouth. A second later, we hear a shout from across the parking lot.
Hey, you, with the cigarette!
We both freeze. Ms. Winters, Nick Nazi. Run! Lindsay screams after a split second, dropping her cigarette. She takes off behind the tennis courts, even though I yell, over here! I see the big blonde poof of Ms. Winters' hair bobbing over the cars. I'm not sure if she's seen us or just heard us laughing. I duck behind a Range Rover and cut across Senior Alley to one of the back doors in the gym as Ms. Winters keeps screaming, "Hey! Hey!" I grab the handle and rattle it, but the door sticks. For a second, my heart stops, and I'm sure it's locked. But then I slam up against it, and it opens into a storage closet. I jump inside and close the door behind me, heart thumping in my chest. A minute later, I hear feet pound past the door. Then I hear Ms. Winters mutter, "Shit!" And the footsteps start retreating backward. The whole thing, the day, the fight in the country's best yogurt, the almost bust, the idea of Lindsay crouching somewhere in the woods in her skirt and new Steve Madden boots, strikes me as so funny I have to clap my hand over my mouth to keep from laughing. The room I'm standing in smells like soccer cleats and jerseys and mud, and with the stack of orange cones and bag full of basketballs piled in the corner, there's barely enough room for me to stand. One side of the room is windowed, and it looks into an office. Otto's, probably, since he basically lives in the gym. I've never actually seen his office. His desk is piled with papers, and there's a computer flashing a screensaver that looks like it's a cheesy picture of a beach. I inch closer to the window, thinking how hilarious it would be if I could bust him with something dirty, like some underwear peeking out of a desk drawer or a porn mag or something. When the door of his office swings open, and there he is. Instantly, I drop to the ground. I have to scrunch up in a ball, and even then, I'm paranoid that my ponytail might be peeking up over the windowsill. It sounds stupid considering everything that's been happening, but all I can think in that moment is, if he sees me, I'm really dead. Goodbye, Allie's house. Hello, detention. My face is sandwiched up next to a half-open duffel bag that looks like it's full of old basketball jerseys. I don't know if they've never been washed or what, but the smell makes me want to gag. I hear Otto moving around his desk, and I'm praying that he doesn't come close enough to the desk to see me bellying up to a bunch of old sports equipment. I can already hear the rumors. Samantha Kingston found humping driver's ed cones. There's a minute or two of shuffling and my legs start cramping. The first bell has already rung for 8, less than 3 minutes to class, but there's no way for me to sneak out. The door is noisy, and besides, I have no way to know which direction he's facing. He could be staring at the door. My only hope is that Otto has class 8, but it doesn't sound like he's in a hustle to be anywhere. I imagine being trapped here until school ends. The stink alone will finish me off. I hear Otto's door creak open again, and I perk up, thinking he's leaving after all. But then a second voice says, "Damn, I missed them." I would recognize that nasal whine anywhere. Ms. Winters. "Smokers?" Otto says. His voice is almost as high-pitched as hers. I had no idea they even knew each other. The only times I've ever seen them in the same room are at all school assemblies when Ms. Winters sits next to Principal Benneter, looking like someone just set off a stink bomb directly under her chair, and Otto sits with the special ed teachers and the health instructor and the driver's ed specialist and all the other weirdos who are on faculty but aren't real teachers.
"Do you know that the students call that little area the Smoker's Lounge?"
I can almost hear Ms. Winters pinching her nose.
"Did you get a look at them?"
Otto asks, and my muscles tense.
"Not a good one. I could hear them and I smelled the smoke."
Lindsay's right. Ms. Winters is definitely half greyhound.
"Next time," Otto says.
"There must be 2,000 cigarette butts out there,"
Ms. Winters says.
"You'd think with all the health videos we show them."
"They're teenagers. They do the opposite of what you say. That's part of the deal. Pimples, pubic hair, and a bad attitude."
I almost lose it when Otto says pubic hair, and I think Ms. Winters will lecture him, but she only says,
"Sometimes I don't know why I bother."
"It's been one of those days, huh?"
Otto says. And there's the sound of someone bumping against a desk and a book thudding to the ground. Ms. Winters actually giggles. And then, I swear to God, I hear them kissing. not little bird pecks either. Open-mouthed, slurpy, moaning kind of kissing. Oh, shit! I literally have to bite my own hand to keep from screaming or crying or bursting out laughing or getting sick or all of the above. This cannot be happening! I am desperate to take out my phone and text the girls, but I don't want to move. Now I really don't want to get caught, since Otto and the Nazi will think I've been spying on their little sex party. Barf! Just when I feel like I can't stand one more second squeezed up next to the sweaty jerseys, listening to Otto and Winter's suck face like they're in some bad porno, the second bell rings. I am now officially late to eighth period.
Oh, God, I'm supposed to be meeting with Beanie,
Ms. Winters says. Beanie's the student's name for Mr. Benatar, the principal. Of all the shocking things that I've heard in the past 2 minutes, the most shocking is that she knows the nickname and uses it.
Get out of here,
Mr. Otto says, and then I swear. I swear. I hear him smack her butt. Oh, my God. This is better than the time Marcy Harris got caught masturbating in the science lab with a test tube up her you-know-what, if you believe the rumors. This is better than the time Bryce Hanley got suspended for briefly running an online porn site. This is better than any scandal that's hit Thomas Jefferson so far.
Do you have class?
Ms. Winter says, practically cooing.
I'm done for the day,
Otto says. My heart sinks. There's no way I'll be able to stay here for another 45 minutes. Never mind the cramp snaking up my hamstrings and thighs. I've got amazing gossip to spread.
But I have to set up for soccer tryouts.
Okay, babe.
Babe?
I'll see you tonight.
8 o'clock.
I hear the door open, and I know Miss Winters has left. Thank God. From the way they were pillow-talking, I was worried I was about to be treated to the symphony of another make-out session. I'm not sure my hamstrings or my psyche could take it. After a few seconds of moving around and tapping some things on the keyboard, I hear Otto go to the door. The room next to me goes dark. Then the door opens and closes, and I know I'm in the clear. I say a silent hallelujah and stand up. The pins and needles in my legs are so bad I nearly topple over, but I toddle over to the door and lean into it. When I make it outside, I stand there stamping my feet and taking long, deep breaths of clean air. Finally, I let it out. I throw my head back and laugh hysterically, cackling and snorting and not even caring if I look deranged. Ms. Winters and Mr. Effing Otto. Who would have guessed it in a million trillion years? As I head up from the gym, it strikes me how strange people are. You can see them every day. You can think you know them. And then you find out you hardly know them at all. I feel exhilarated. Kind of like I'm being spun around a whirlpool, circling closer and closer around the same people and the same events, but seeing things from different angles. I'm still giggling when I get to Maine, even though Mr. Cummer will freak that I'm late, and I still have to stop by my locker and pick up my Spanish textbook. He told us on the first day that we should treat our textbooks like children. Obviously, he doesn't have any. I'm pressing send on a text to Elodie, Allie, and Lindsay. You'll never believe what just happened when, bam, I run smack into Lauren Lornet. Both of us stumble backward, and my phone flies out of my hand and skitters across the hall. Shit! We collide so hard it takes me a second to recover my breath. Watch where you're going! I start toward my phone, wondering if I can ask her to pay if the screen's cracked or something, when she grabs my arm, hard. What the? Tell them! She says wildly, pushing her face up to mine. You've got to tell them. What are you talking about? I try to pull away, but she grabs my other arm too, like she wants to shake me. Her face is red and splotchy, and she has an all-over sticky look. It's obvious she's been crying. Tell them I didn't do anything wrong. She jerks her head back over her shoulder. We're standing directly in front of the main office, and I see her in that moment the way she was yesterday, hair hanging over her face, tearing down the hall. I really don't know what you're talking about, I say as gently as possible because she's freaking me out. She probably has bi-weekly visits with the school psychologist to control her paranoia or OCD or whatever her issue is. She takes a deep breath. Her voice is shaky. They think I cheated off you and Kim. Beanie called me in, but I didn't. I swear to God, I didn't. I've been studying. I jerk back, but she keeps her grip on my arms. The feeling of being caught in a whirlpool returns, but this time it's horrible. I'm being pulled down, 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 like there's a weight on me. You cheated off me? My words feel like they're coming from a distance. I don't even sound like myself. I didn't. I swear to God, I... Lauren gives a shuddering sob. He'll fail me. He said he would fail me if my grades didn't get better, and I got a tutor, and now they think I... He said he called Penn State. I'll never go to college, and I... You don't understand. My dad'll kill me. He'll kill me. She really does shake me then. Her eyes are full of panic. You have to tell them. I finally manage to wrench away. I feel hot and sick. I don't want to know this. Don't want to know any of it. I can't help you, I say, backing away, still feeling like I'm not actually saying the words, just hearing them spoken aloud from somewhere. Lauren looks like I've just slapped her. What? What do you mean you can't help? Just tell them! My hands are shaking as I go to pick up my phone. It slips out of my grasp twice and lands back on the floor both times with a clatter. It's not supposed to be like this. I feel like someone's pressed the reverse button on a vacuum cleaner and all of the junk I've done is spewing back onto the carpet for me to see. You're lucky you didn't break my phone, I say, feeling numb. This cost me $200. Were you even listening to me? Lauren's voice is rising hysterically. I can't bring myself to meet her eyes. I'm screwed. I'm finished. I can't help you, I say again. It's like I can't remember any other words. Lauren lets out something that's halfway between a scream and a sob. You said I shouldn't be nice to you today. You know what? You were right. You're awful. You're a bitch. You're... Suddenly, it's like she remembers where we are, who she is and who I am. She claps her hand over her mouth so quickly it makes a hollow, echoing sound in the hallway. Oh, God. Now her voice comes out as a whisper. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it. I don't even answer. Those words, you're a bitch, make my whole body go cold. I'm sorry. Please don't be mad. I can't stand it. Can't stand to hear her apologize to me. And before I know it, I'm running, full out, running down the hall, my heart pounding, feeling like I need to scream or cry or smash my fist into something. She calls after me, but I don't know what it is. I don't care. I can't know. And when I push into the girls' bathroom, I throw my back against the door and sink down against it until my knees are pressed into my chest, my throat squeezed up so tight it hurts to breathe. My phone keeps buzzing, and once I've calmed down a bit, I flip it open and find texts from Lindsay, Allie, and Elodie. What? Dish? Spill? Did you make up with Rob? I throw my phone into my bag and rest my head in my hands, waiting for my pulse to return to normal. All of the happiness I felt earlier is gone. Even the Otto and Winters situation doesn't seem funny anymore. Bridget and Alex and Anna and Sarah Grundle and her stupid parking space and Lauren Lornit and the chem test. It feels like I've been caught up in some enormous web, and every way I turn, I see that I'm stuck to someone else, all of us wriggling around in the same net. And I don't want to know any of it. It's not my problem. I don't care. You're a bitch. I don't care. I have bigger things to worry about. Finally, I stand up. I've given up on going to Spanish. Instead, I splash cold water on my face and then reapply my makeup. My face is so pale under the harsh fluorescent lights, I hardly recognize it. Only the dream.
Come on, cheer up.
Lindsay whacks me on the head with a pillow. We're sitting on the couch in Allie's den. Elodie pops the last spicy tuna roll into her mouth, which I'm not sure is such a great idea, as it's now been perched on an ottoman for the past 3 hours.
Don't worry, Sammy. Rob will get over it.
All of them think Rob's the reason I'm quiet, but of course it isn't. I'm quiet because as soon as the clock inched its way past 12, the fear crept back in. It's been filling me slowly, like sand running through an hourglass. With every second, I'm getting closer and closer to the moment. Ground zero. This morning, I was certain that it was simple, that all I had to do was stay away from the party, stay away from the car, that time would lurch back on track, that I would be saved. But now my heart feels like it's being squashed between my ribs, and it gets harder and harder to breathe. I'm terrified that in 1 second, in the space between a breath, everything will evaporate into darkness, and I'll once again find myself alone in my bedroom at home, waking up to the screaming of the alarm. I don't know what I'll do if that happens. I think my heart will break. I think my heart will stop. Allie switches off the television and throws down the remote.
What should we do now?
Let me consult the spirits.
Elodie slides off the couch and onto the floor where earlier we'd set up a dusty Ouija board for old time's sake. We tried to play, but everyone was obviously pushing, and the indicator kept zipping onto words like penis and chode until Lindsay started screaming, "Perv spirits, child molesters," into the air. Elodie shoves the indicator with 2 fingers. It spins once before settling over the word yes.
"Look, Ma."
She holds up her hands.
"No hands."
It wasn't a yes or no question, doofus.
Lindsay rolls her eyes and takes a big sip of the Chateau Neuf de Pape we swiped from the wine cellar.
"This town sucks," Allie says. "Nothing ever happens."
12:33. 12:34. I have never seen seconds and minutes rush by so fast, tumble over one another. 12:35. 12:36.
"We need music or something,"
Lindsay says, jumping up.
"We can't just sit around here like bums."
"Definitely music," Elodie says.
She and Lindsay run into the next room where the Bose sound dock is.
"No music,"
I groan, but it's too late. Beyonce is already blasting. The vases begin to rattle on the bookshelves. My head feels like it's going to explode, and chills are running up and down my body. 12:37. I nestle deeper into the couch, drawing a blanket up over my knees and cover my ears. Lindsay and Elodie march back into the room. We're all in old boxer shorts and tank tops. Lindsay's obviously just raided Allie's mudroom because she and Elodie are now also decked out in ski goggles and fleece hats. Elodie's hobbling along with 1 foot jammed in a child's snowshoe.
"Oh my God!"
Allie screams. She holds her stomach and doubles over laughing. Lindsay gyrates with a ski pole between her legs, rocking back and forth.
"Oh, Patrick! Patrick!"
The music is so loud I can barely hear her, even when I take my hands off my ears. 12:38. 1 minute.
"Come on,"
Elodie shouts, extending her hand to me. I'm so full of fear I can't move, can't even shake my head. And she leans forward and yells,
"Live a little."
So many thoughts and words are tumbling through my head. I want to yell, "No, stop," or "Yes, live." But all I can do is squeeze my eyes shut and picture seconds running like water into an infinite pool. And I imagine all of us hurtling through time. And I think, now, now, it's going to happen now. And then everything goes silent. I'm afraid to open my eyes. A deep emptiness opens up inside me. I feel nothing. This is what it's like to be dead. Then a voice.
"Too loud! You'll blow out your eardrums before you're 20.
I snap open my eyes. Mrs. Harris, Allie's mom, is standing in the doorway in a glistening raincoat, smoothing down her hair. And Lindsay's standing there in her ski goggles and hat, and Elodie's awkwardly trying to pry her foot out of the snowshoe. I made it. It worked. Relief and joy flood me with so much force I almost cry out. But instead, I laugh. I burst out laughing in the silence, and Allie gives me a dirty look like, now you decide it's funny?
Are you girls drunk?
Allie's mother stares at each of us in turn and then frowns at the nearly empty bottle of wine on the floor.
Hardly. Allie throws herself on the couch.
You kill the buzz.
Lindsay flips the goggles onto her head.
We were having a dance party, Mrs. Harris.
She says brightly, as if dancing around half-naked and decked out in winter sports equipment was a Girl Scouts mandated activity. Mrs. Harris sighs.
Not anymore. It's been a long day. I'm going to bed.
Mom!
Allie whines. Mrs. Harris shoots her a look.
No more music.
Elodie finally wrenches her foot free and stumbles backward, collapsing against one of the bookshelves. Martha Stewart's homekeeping handbook comes flying out and lands at her feet.
Oops.
She turns bright red and looks at Mrs. Harris like she expects to be spanked any minute. I can't help it. I start giggling again. Mrs. Harris rolls her eyes to the ceiling and shakes her head.
Good night, girls.
Nice going.
Allie leans over and pinches my thigh.
Retard!
Elodie starts giggling and imitates Lindsay's voice.
We were having a dance party, Mrs. Harris.
At least I didn't fall into a bookshelf.
Lindsay bends over and wiggles her butt at us.
Kiss it.
Maybe I will.
Elodie dives for her, pretending like she's going to. Lindsay shrieks and dodges her. Allie hisses, shh, right as we hear Mrs. Harris yell, girls, from upstairs. Pretty soon they're all laughing. It feels great to laugh with them.
I'm back.
An hour later, Lindsay, Elodie, and I are settled on the L-shaped couch. Elodie has the top bit, and Lindsay and I are lying end to end. My feet are pressed against Lindsay's, and she keeps wiggling her toes to annoy me. But nothing can annoy me right now. Allie has dragged in her air mattress and her blankets from upstairs. She insists she can't sleep without her society comforter.
It's just like freshman year.
We've put the television on low because Elodie likes the sound, and in the dark room, the glow of the screen reminds me of summers spent breaking into the pool club to go night swimming, of the way the light shines up through all that black water, of stillness and feeling like you're the only person alive in the whole world.
You guys, I whisper. I'm not sure who's still awake.
Lindsay grunts. I close my eyes, letting the feeling of peace sweep over me, fill me from head to toe.
If you had to relive one day, over and over, which one would you pick?
Nobody answers me, and in a little while I hear Allie start snoring into her pillow. They're all asleep. I'm not tired yet. I'm still too exhilarated to be here, to be safe, to have broken out of whatever bubble of time and space has been confining me. But I close my eyes anyway and try to imagine what kind of day I would choose. Memories speed by, dozens and dozens of parties, shopping trips with Lindsay, pigging out at sleepovers and crying over the notebook with Elodie, and even before that, family vacations and my 8th birthday party and the first time I ever dove off the high board at the pool and the water fizzed up my nose and left me dizzy. But all of them seem imperfect somehow, spotted and shadowy. On a perfect day, there wouldn't be any school, that's for sure. And there would be pancakes for breakfast. My mom's pancakes. And my dad would make his famous fried eggs, and Izzy would set the table like she sometimes does at holidays with different mismatched plates and fruit and flowers that she gathers from around the house and dumps in the middle of the table and calls a centerpiece. I close my eyes and feel myself letting go, like tipping over the edge of an abyss. Darkness rising up to carry me away.
Bring, bring, bring!
I'm pulled back from the edge of sleep, and for one horrible second, I think, It's my alarm. I'm home. It's happening again. I strike out, a spasm, and Lindsay yelps, "Ow!" The sound of that one word makes my heart go still, and my breathing return to normal. Bring, bring, bring! Now that I'm fully alert, I realize it's not my alarm. It's the telephone, ringing shrilly in various rooms, creating a weird echo effect. I check the clock. 1:52. Elodie groans. Allie rolls over and murmurs, "Turn it off!" The telephone stops ringing and then starts again, and all of a sudden Allie sits up straight as a rod, totally awake. She says, "Shit, shit! My mom's gonna kill me!"
"Make it stop, Al," Lindsay says from underneath her pillow.
Allie tries to untangle herself from her sheets, still muttering, "Shit! Where's the freaking phone?" She trips and ends up stumbling out of bed and hitting the ground with her shoulder. Elodie moans again, this time louder. Lindsay says,
"I'm trying to sleep, people."
"I need the phone," Allie hisses back. It's too late anyway. I hear footsteps moving upstairs. Mrs. Harris has obviously woken up. A second later, the phone stops ringing.
"Thank God."
Lindsay rustles around, burrowing farther under her covers. It's almost 2. Allie stands up. I can see the vague outline of her form hobbling back over to the bed. Who the hell calls at 2 in the morning?
Maybe it's Matt Wilde confessing his love, Lindsay says.
Very funny, Allie says. She settles back in bed and we all get quiet. I can just hear the low murmur of Mrs. Harris's voice above us, the creaking of her footsteps as she paces. Then I very distinctly hear her say,
"Oh, no. Oh, my God."
"Allie," I start. But she's heard it, too. She gets up and turns on the light, then switches off the television, which is still on low. The sudden brightness makes me wince. Lindsay curses and pulls the covers over her head. "Something's wrong." Allie hugs herself, blinking rapidly. Elodie reaches for her glasses, then props herself up on 2 elbows. Eventually, Lindsay realizes the light's not going off, and she emerges from under her cocoon.
"What's the problem?"
She balls her hands into fists, rubbing her eyes. No one answers. We all have a growing sense of it now. Something is very wrong. Allie's just standing there in the middle of the room. In her oversized t-shirt and baggy shorts, she looks much younger than she is. At a certain point, the voice upstairs stops, and the footsteps move diagonally across the floor in the direction of the stairs. Allie moves back to the air mattress, folding her legs underneath her and biting her nails. Mrs. Harris doesn't seem surprised to find us sitting up waiting for her. She's wearing a long silk nightgown and has an eye mask perched on top of her head. I've never seen Mrs. Harris looking less than perfect, and it makes fear yawn open in my stomach. "What?" Allie's voice is semi-hysterical. "What happened? Is it Dad?" Mrs. Harris blinks and seems to focus on us like she's just been called out of a dream.
"No, no, it's not your father."
She takes a breath, then blows it out loudly.
"Listen, girls, what I'm about to tell you is very upsetting. I'm only telling you in the first place because you'll find out soon enough."
"Just tell us, Mom."
Mrs. Harris nods slowly.
"You all know Juliet Sykes."
This is a shock. We all look at one another completely bewildered. Of all the words that Mrs. Harris could have said at this moment, I'm pretty sure "you all know Juliet Sykes" ranks pretty high on our list of the unexpected. "Yeah? So?" Allie shrugs.
"Well, she..."
Mrs. Harris breaks off, smoothing down her nightgown with her hands and starts again.
"That was Mindy Sachs on the phone."
Lindsay raises her eyebrows and Allie gives a knowing sigh. "We all know Mindy Sachs, too. She's 50 and divorced, but still dresses and acts like a sophomore. She's more gossip-obsessed than anybody at our school." Whenever I see Ms. Sachs, I'm reminded of the game we used to play when we were kids, where one person whispers a secret and the next person repeats it and so on, except in Ridgeview, Ms. Sachs is the only one doing the whispering. She and Mrs. Harris sit on the school board together, so Mrs. Harris always knows about divorces and who just lost all their money and who's having an affair.
Mindy lives just next to the Sykes,
Mrs. Harris continues.
Apparently, their street has been swarming with ambulances for the past half hour.
I don't get it, Allie says, and maybe it's the hour or the stress of the past few days, but I'm not getting it either. Mrs. Harris has her arms folded across her chest, and she hugs herself a little like she's cold.
Juliet Sykes is dead. She killed herself tonight.
Silence. Total silence. Allie stops chewing on her nails, and Lindsay sits as still as I've ever seen her. I really think for several seconds my heart stops beating. I feel a strange tunneling sensation like I've been parachuted out of my body and am now just looking at it from far away, like for a few moments we're all just pictures of ourselves. I'm suddenly reminded of a story my parents once told me. Back when Thomas Jefferson was called Suicide High, some guy hanged himself inside his own closet right there among the mothball-smelling sweaters and old sneakers and everything. He was a loser and played in the band and had bad skin and next to no friends. So nobody thought anything of it when he died. I mean, people were sad and everything, but they got it. But the next year to the day, one of the most popular guys in school killed himself in the exact same way. Everything was the same, method, time, place. Except this guy was captain of the swim team and the soccer team, and apparently when the police went into the closet, there were so many old athletic trophies on the shelves it looked like he'd been entombed in a gold vault. He left only a one-line note. We are all hangmen.
How? Elodie asks, barely a whisper.
Mrs. Harris shakes her head, and for a second I think she might cry.
Mindy heard the gunshot. She thought it was a firecracker. She thought it was a prank.
She shot herself? Allie says it quietly, almost reverentially, and I know we're all thinking the same thing. That's the worst way of any.
How are they?
Elodie adjusts her glasses and licks her lips.
Do they know why?
There was no note,
Mrs. Harris says, and I swear I can hear something go around the room, a tiny exhalation, a breath of relief.
I just thought you should know.
She goes to Allie and bends over, kissing her forehead. Allie pulls away, maybe in surprise. I've never seen Mrs. Harris kiss Allie before. I've never seen Mrs. Harris look so much like a mother before. After Mrs. Harris leaves, we all sit there while the silence stretches out and expands in huge rings around us. I feel like we're all waiting for something, but I'm not sure what. Finally, Elodie speaks.
Do you think?
Elodie swallows, looking back and forth from one to the other of us.
Do you think it's because of our rose?
Don't be stupid, Lindsay snaps. I can tell she's upset, though. Her face is pale, and she twists and untwists the edge of her blanket.
It's not like it was the first time.
That makes it even worse, Allie says.
At least we knew who she was.
Lindsay catches me staring at her hands, and she places them firmly in her lap.
Most people just acted like she was invisible.
Allie bites her lip.
Still, on her last day?
Elodie trails off. She's better off this way, Lindsay says. This is low even for her, and we all stare.
What?
She lifts her chin and stares back at us defiantly.
You know you're all thinking it. She was miserable. She escaped. Done.
But, I mean, things could have gotten better, I say.
They wouldn't have,
Lindsay says. Hallie shakes her head and draws her knees to her chest.
God, Lindsay.
I'm in shock. The weirdest part of it all is the gun. It seems so harsh, so loud, so physical a way to do it. Blood and brains and searing heat. If she had to do it to die, she should have drowned, should have just walked into the water until it folded over her head, or she should have jumped. I picture Juliet floating this way and that like she's being supported by currents of air. I can imagine her spreading her arms and leaping off a bridge or a canyon somewhere, but in my head, she starts soaring upward on the wind as soon as her feet leave the ground. Not a gun. Guns are for cop dramas and 7-Eleven holdups and crack addicts and gang fights, not for Juliet Sykes.
Maybe we should have been nicer to her, Elodie says.
She looks down like she's embarrassed to say it. Please. Lindsay's voice is loud and hard in comparison. You can't be mean to someone forever and then feel bad when she dies. Elodie lifts her head and stares at Lindsay.
But I do feel bad.
Her voice is getting stronger.
Then you're a hypocrite, Lindsay says. And that's worse than anything.
She gets up and shuts off the light. I hear her climb back on the couch and rustle around in the blankets, settling in.
If you'll excuse me, she says, I have sleep to catch up on.
There's total silence for a while. I'm not sure if Allie's lying down or not, but as my eyes adjust to the darkness, I see that she isn't. She's still sitting there with her knees drawn up to her chest, staring straight ahead. After a minute, she says,
I'm going to sleep upstairs.
She gathers up her sheets and blankets, making extra noise, probably to get back at Lindsay. A moment later, Elodie says,
I'm going with her. The couch is too lumpy.
She's obviously upset, too. We've been sleeping on this couch for years. After she leaves, I sit for a while listening to Lindsay breathe. I wonder if she's sleeping. I don't see how she could be. I feel as awake as I've ever been. Then again, Lindsay's always been different from most people. Less sensitive, more black and white. My team, your team. This side of the line, that side of the line. Fearless and careless. I've always admired her for that. We all have. I feel restless, like I need to know the answers to questions I'm not sure how to ask. I ease off the couch slowly, trying not to wake Lindsay, but it turns out she's not sleeping after all. She rolls over, and in the dark, I can just make out her pale skin and the deep hollows of her eyes.
You're not going upstairs, are you?
She whispers. Bathroom, I whisper back. I feel my way out into the hallway and pause there. Somewhere a clock is ticking, but other than that, it's totally silent. Everything is dark, and the stone floor is cold under my feet. I run one hand along the wall to orient myself. The sound of the rain has stopped. When I look outside, I see the rain has turned to snow, thousands of snowflakes melting down the latticed windows and making the moonlight that comes through the panes look watery and full of movement, shadows twisting and blurring on the floor, alive. There's a bathroom here, but that's not where I'm headed. I ease open the door that leads to Allie's basement and grope my way down the stairs, holding on to both banisters. As soon as my feet hit the carpet at the bottom of the stairs, I fumble on the wall to my left, eventually finding the light switch. The basement is suddenly revealed, big and stark and normal-looking. Beige leather couches, an old ping-pong table, another flat-screen TV, and a circular area with a treadmill, an elliptical machine, and a three-sided mirror at its center. It's cooler here and smells like chemicals and new paint. Just beyond the exercise area is another door, which leads into the room we've always referred to as the altar of Allison Harris. The room is papered with Allie's old drawings, none of them good, most dating back to elementary school. The bookshelves are crowded with pictures of her. Allie dressed up like an octopus for Halloween in first grade. Allie wearing a green velvet dress and smiling in front of an enormous Christmas tree, absolutely collapsing with ornaments. Allie squinting in a bikini, Allie laughing, Allie frowning, Allie looking pensive. And on the lowest shelf, every single one of Allie's old yearbooks, from kindergarten on. Allie once showed us how Mrs. Harris had gone through all the books one by one, placing colored sticky tabs on each one of Allie's friends from year to year.
"So you can remember how popular you always were," Mrs. Harris had told her.
I dropped to my knees. I'm not sure exactly what I'm looking for, but there's an idea taking shape in my head. Some old memory that disappears whenever I will it to take form. Like those magic eye games where you can only see the hidden shape when your eyes aren't in focus. I start with the first grade yearbook. I open it directly to Mr. Christensen's class. Just my luck, and there I am, standing a little ways apart from the group. The flash reflected in my glasses makes it impossible to see my eyes. My smile is closer to a wince, as though the effort hurts. I flip past the picture quickly. I hate looking through old yearbooks. They don't exactly bring back a flood of positive memories. Mine are stashed somewhere in the attic with all the other crap my mom insists I keep, because you might want it later. Like my old dolls and a ratty stuffed lamb I used to carry with me everywhere. 2 pages later, I find what I'm looking for. Mrs. Novak's first grade class. And there Lindsay is. Front and center, as always, beaming a big smile at the camera. Next to her is a thin, pretty girl with a shy smile and hair so blonde it could be white. She and Lindsay are standing so close together their arms are touching all the way from their elbows to their fingertips. Juliet Sykes. In the second grade yearbook, Lindsay is kneeling in the front row of her class. Again, Juliet Sykes is next to her. In the third grade yearbook, Juliet and Lindsay are separated by several pages. Lindsay was in Ms. Derner's class, with me. That was the year she invented the joke, "What's red and white and weird all over?" Juliet was in Dr. Kuzma's class. Different pages, different classes, different poses. Lindsay has her hands clasped in front of her. Juliet is standing with her body angled slightly to the side. And yet, they look exactly the same. Wearing identical powder blue petite bateau t-shirts and matching white capri pants, which cut off just below the knee. Their hair, blonde and shining, parted neatly down the middle, the glint of a small silver chain around both of their necks. That was the year it was cool to dress up like your friends, your best friends. I pick up the fourth grade yearbook next, my fingers heavy and numb, cold running through me. There's a big Technicolor portrait of the school on its cover, all neon pinks and reds, probably painted by an art teacher. It takes me a while to find Lindsay's class, but as soon as I do, my heart starts racing. There she is with that same huge smile, like she's daring the camera to catch her looking less than perfect. And next to her is Juliet Sykes. Pretty, happy Juliet Sykes, smiling like she has a secret. I squint, focusing on a tiny blurred spot between them, and think I can just make out that their index fingers are linked together loosely. Fifth grade. I find Lindsay easily, standing front and center in Mrs. Krakow's classroom, smiling so widely it looks like she's baring her teeth. It takes me longer to find Juliet. I go through all the photographs looking for her and have to start over from the beginning before I spot her, far up in the right-hand corner, sandwiched between Lauren Lornet and Eileen Cho, shrinking backward like she wants to suck herself out of the frame altogether. Her hair hangs in front of her face like a curtain. Next to her, both Lauren and Eileen are angled slightly away, as though they don't want to be associated with her, as though she has some contagious disease. Fifth grade, the year of the Girl Scout trip, when she peed in her sleeping bag and Lindsay nicknamed her Mellow Yellow. I put the yearbooks back carefully, making sure to order them correctly. My heart is thumping wildly, an out-of-control drum rhythm. I suddenly want to get out of the basement as quickly as possible. I shut off the lights and feel my way up the stairs blindly. The darkness seems to swirl with shapes and shadows, and terror rises in my throat. I'm sure that if I turn around, I'll see her, all in white, stumbling with her hands outstretched, reaching for me, face bloody and broken apart. And then I'm upstairs and there she is. A vision. A nightmare.
Her face is completely in shadow, a hole, but I can tell she's staring at me. The room tilts. I grab onto the wall to keep myself steady.
What's your problem?
Lindsay steps farther into the hall, the moonlight falling differently so that her features emerge.
Why are you looking at me like that?
Jesus! I bring my hand to my chest, trying to press my heart back to its normal rhythm. You scared me.
What were you doing down there?
Her hair is messed up, and in her white boxers and tank top, she could be a ghost. You were friends with her, I say.
It pops out like an accusation. You were friends with her for years.
I'm not sure what answer I'm expecting, but she looks away and then looks back at me.
It's not our fault, she says, like she's daring me to contradict her. She's totally whacked. You know that.
I know, I say. But I get the feeling she's not even talking to me.
And I heard her dad's like an alcoholic.
Lindsay presses on, her voice suddenly quick, urgent.
Her whole family's whacked.
Yeah, I say. For a minute, we just stand there in silence. My body feels heavy, useless, the way it sometimes does in nightmares when you have to run but you can't. After a while, something occurs to me and I say, was. Even though we've been standing in silence, Lindsay inhales sharply as though I've interrupted her in the middle of a long speech.
What?
She was whacked, I say. She's not anything anymore. Lindsay doesn't respond. I go past her into the dark hallway and find my way to the couch. I settle in under the blankets, and a little while later, she comes in and joins me. Lying there, convinced I won't be able to sleep, I remember the time in the middle of junior year when Lindsay and I snuck out on a random weeknight, a Tuesday or a Thursday, and drove around because there was nothing else to do. At some point, she pulled over abruptly on Fallow Ridge Road and cut the headlights, waiting until another car began to squeeze its way toward us on the single-lane road. Then she roared the engine and blazed the lights to life and began careening straight toward it. I was screaming at the top of my lungs, the headlights growing huge as suns, certain we were going to die, and she was gripping the steering wheel and calling out over my screams, "Don't worry, they always swerve first." She was right, too. At the last second, the other car jerked abruptly into the ditch. That's what I remember just before the dream pulls me under. In my dream, I am falling through darkness. In my dream, I fall forever. Chapter 4. Even before I'm awake, the alarm clock is in my hand, and I break from sleep completely at the same moment I hurl the clock against the wall. It lets out a final wail before shattering.
Whoa,
Lindsay says when I slide into the car 15 minutes later.
Is there a job opening in the red light district I don't know about?
Just drive. I can barely look at her. Anger is seething through me like liquid. She's a fraud. The whole world is a fraud. One bright, shiny scam. And somehow I'm the one paying for it. I'm the one who died. I'm the one who's trapped. Here's the thing. It shouldn't be me. Lindsay's the one who drives like she's in the real-life version of Grand Theft Auto. Lindsay's the one who's always thinking of ways to punk people or humiliate them, who's always criticizing everybody. Lindsay's the one who lied about being friends with Juliet Sykes and then tortured her all those years. I didn't do anything. I just followed along.
You're gonna freeze, you know.
Lindsay chucks her cigarette and rolls up the window. Thanks, Mom. I flip down the mirror to make sure that my lipstick hasn't smeared. I've folded my skirt over a couple of times so it barely covers my ass when I sit down, and I'm wearing 5-inch platforms that I bought with Allie as a joke at a store that we were pretty sure only caters to strippers. I've kept the fur-trim tank top, but I've added a rhinestone necklace, again purchased as a joke one Halloween when we all dressed up as naughty nurses. It says slut in big, sparkly script. I don't care. I'm in the mood to get looked at,
I feel like I could do anything right now. Punch somebody in the face, rob a bank, get drunk, and do something stupid. That's the only benefit to being dead. No consequences. Lindsay misses my sarcasm or ignores it.
I'm surprised your parents even let you out of the house like that.
They didn't. Another thing making my mood foul is the 10-minute screaming match I had with my mother before storming out of the house. Even when Izzy went to hide in her room and my father threatened to ground me for life, the words kept coming. It felt so good to scream, like when you pick a scab and the blood starts flowing again. You are not walking out that door unless you go upstairs and put on some more clothing. That's what my mom said. You'll catch pneumonia. More important, I don't want people in school getting the wrong impression about you. And suddenly, it had all snapped inside of me, broken and snapped. You care now? She jerked back at the sound of my voice like I'd reached out and slapped her. You want to help now? You want to protect me now? What I really wanted to say was, where were you 4 days ago? Where were you when my car was spinning off the edge of a road in the middle of the night? Why weren't you thinking of me? Why weren't you there? I hate both of my parents right now for sitting quietly in our house while out in the darkness my heart was beating away all of the seconds of my life, ticking them off one by one until my time was up. For letting the thread between us stretch so far and so thin that the moment it was severed for good, they didn't even feel it. At the same time, I know that it's not really their fault, at least not completely. I did my part too. I did it on 100 different days and in 1,000 different ways, and I know it. But this makes the anger worse, not better. Your parents are supposed to keep you safe.
Jesus, what is your problem?
Lindsay looks at me hard for a second.
You wake up on the wrong side of the bed or something?
For a few days now, yeah. I'm getting really sick of this low half-light, the sky a pale and sickly blue, not even a real blue, and the sun a wet mess on the horizon. I read once that starving people start fantasizing about food, just lying there dreaming for hours about hot mashed potatoes and creamy blobs of butter and steak running red blood over their plates. Now I get it. I'm starved for different light, a different sun, different sky. I've never really thought about it before, but it's a miracle how many kinds of light there are in the world, how many skies. The pale brightness of spring when it feels like the whole world is blushing. The lush, bright boldness of a July noon. Purple storm skies and a green queasiness just before lightning strikes and crazy multicolored sunsets that look like someone's acid trip. I should have enjoyed them more. Should have memorized them all. I should have died on a day with a beautiful sunset. I should have died on summer vacation or winter break. I should have died on any other day. Leaning my forehead against the window, I fantasize about sending my fist up through the glass, all the way into the sky and watching it shatter like a mirror. I think about what I'll do to survive all of the millions and millions of days that will be exactly like this one. Two face-to-face mirrors multiplying a reflection into infinity. I start formulating a plan. I'll stop coming to school, and I'll jack somebody's car and drive as far as I can in a different direction every day. East, west, north, south. I allow myself to fantasize about going so far and so fast that I lift off like an airplane, zooming straight up and out to a place where time falls away like sand being blown off a surface by the wind. Remember what I said about hope?
Happy Cupid Day!
Elodie sings songs when she gets into the tank. Lindsay stares from Elodie back to me.
What is this? Some kind of competition for least dressed?
If you got it, flaunt it.
Elodie eyes my skirt as she leans forward to grab her coffee.
Forget your pants, Sam.
Lindsay snickers. I say, jealous much?
without turning away from the window.
What's wrong with her?
Elodie leans back.
Someone forgot to take her happy pills this morning.
Out of the corner of my eye, I see Lindsay look back at Elodie and make a face like, leave it. Like I'm a kid who needs to be handled. I think of those old photos where she's standing pressed arm to arm with Juliet Sykes, and then I think of Juliet's head blown open and splattered on some basement wall. Again, the fury returns, and it's all I can do to keep from turning to her and screaming that she's a fake, a liar, that I can see right through her. I see right through you.
My heart flips when I remember Kent's words. I know something that'll cheer you up.
Elodie starts rummaging around in her bag, looking pleased with herself. I swear to God, Elodie, if you're about to give me a condom right now. I press my fingers to my temples. Elodie freezes and frowns, holding up a condom between two fingers.
But it's your present.
She looks at Lindsay for support. Lindsay shrugs.
Up to you, she says.
She's not looking at me, but I can tell my attitude is really starting to piss her off. And to be honest, I'm happy about it.
If you want to be a walking STD farm,
you would know all about that. I don't even mean for it to slip out. It just does. Lindsay whips around to face me.
What did you say?
Nothing. Did you say? I didn't say anything. I lean my head against the glass. Elodie's still sitting there with the condom dangling between her fingers.
Come on, Sam. No glove, no love, right?
Losing my virginity seems absurd to me now. The plot point of a different movie, a different character, a different lifetime. I try to reach back and remember what I love about Rob, what I loved about him, but all I get is a random collection of images in no particular order. Rob passing out on Kent's couch, grabbing my arm and accusing me of cheating. Rob laying his head on my shoulder in his basement, whispering that he wants to fall asleep next to me. Rob turning his back on me in sixth grade. Rob holding up his hand and saying, 5 minutes. Rob taking my hand for the first time ever when we were walking through the hall, a feeling of pride and strength going through me. They seem like the memories of somebody else. That's when it really hits me. None of it matters anymore. Nothing matters anymore. I twist around in my seat, reaching back to grab the condom from Elodie. No glove, no love, I say, giving her a tight smile. Elodie cheers.
That's my girl.
I'm turning around again when Lindsay slams on the brakes at a red light. I jet forward and have to reach out one hand to keep from hitting the dash, and then, as the car stops moving, slam back against the headrest. The coffee in the cup holder jumps its lip and splashes my thigh.
Oops, Lindsay giggles. So sorry.
You really are a hazard,
Elodie laughs and reaches around to buckle her seatbelt. The anger I felt all morning pours out in a rush. What the hell is wrong with you? Lindsay's smile freezes on her face.
Excuse me?
I said, what the hell is wrong with you? I grab some napkins from inside the glove compartment and start wiping off my leg. The coffee's not even that hot. Lindsay had the lid off to cool it, but it leaves a splotchy red mark on my thigh, and I feel like crying. It's not that hard. Red light, stop. Green light, go. I know that yellow might be a little harder for you to grasp, but you'd think with a little practice, you could come to terms with it. Lindsay and Elodie are both staring at me in stunned silence. But I don't stop. I can't stop. This is all Lindsay's fault. Lindsay and her stupid driving. They could train monkeys to drive better than you. So what? What is it? You need to prove you don't give a shit? That you don't care about anything? You don't care about anybody? Tap a fender here, swipe a mirror there. Oops, thank God we have our airbags. That's what bumpers are for. Just keep going, keep driving. No one will ever know. Guess what, Lindsay? You don't have to prove anything. We already know you don't give a shit about anybody but yourself. We've always known. I run out of air then, and for a second after I stop speaking, there's total silence. Lindsay's not even looking at me.
She's staring straight ahead, both hands on the wheel, knuckles white from clutching it so tightly. The light turns green and she presses her foot on the accelerator, hard. The engine roars, sounding like distant thunder. It takes Lindsay a while to speak, and when she does, her voice is low and strangled sounding.
Where the hell do you get off?
Guys, Elodie pipes up nervously from the back. Don't fight, okay? Just drop it. The anger is still running through me, an electrical current. It makes me feel sharper and more alert than I have in years. I whirl around to face Elodie. How come you never stand up for yourself? I say. She shrinks back a little, her eyes darting between Lindsay and me. You know it's true. She's a bitch. Go ahead, say it.
Leave her out of this,
Lindsay hisses. Elodie opens her mouth and then gives a minute shake of her head. I knew it, I say, feeling triumphant and sick at the same time. You're scared of her.
I knew it. I told you to leave her alone.
Lindsay finally raises her voice.
I'm supposed to leave her alone?
The sharpness, the sense of clarity is disappearing. Instead, everything feels like it's spinning out of my control.
You're the one who treats her like shit all the time. It's you!
Elodie's so pathetic. Look at Elodie climbing all over Steve. He doesn't even like her. Look, Elodie's trashed again. Hope she doesn't puke in my car. Don't want the leather to smell like alcoholic. Elodie draws in a sharp breath on the last word. I know I've gone too far. The second I say it, I want to take it back. My mirror is still flipped down, and I can see Elodie staring out the window, mouth quivering like she's trying not to cry. Number one rule of best friends. There are certain things that you never, ever say. All of a sudden, Lindsay slams on the brakes. We're in the middle of Route 120, about a half mile from school, but there's a line of traffic behind us. A car has to swerve into the other lane to avoid hitting us. Thankfully, there's no oncoming traffic. Even Elodie cries out, Jesus! My heart is racing. The car passes us, honking furiously. The passenger rolls down his window and yells something, but I can't hear it. I just see the flash of a baseball hat and angry eyes. What are you doing? The people in the cars in line behind us start leaning on their horns, too, but Lindsay throws the car in park and doesn't move. Lindsay, Elodie says anxiously, Sam's right. It's not funny. Lindsay lunges for me, and I think she's going to hit me. Instead, she leans over and shoves open the door.
Out,
she says quietly, her voice full of rage. What? The cold air rushes into the car like a punch to the stomach, leaving me deflated. The last of my anger and fearlessness goes with it, and I just feel tired. Lins, Elodie tries to laugh, but the sound comes out high-pitched and hysterical. You can't make her walk. It's freezing.
Out,
Lindsay repeats. Cars are starting to pull around us now, everyone honking and rolling down their windows to yell at us. All of their words get lost in the roar of the engines and the bleeding of the horns, but it's still humiliating. The idea of getting out now, of being forced to walk in the gutter while all of those dozens of cars roll by me, with all those people watching, makes me shrink back against my seat. I look to Elodie for more support, but she looks away. Lindsay leans over.
I said get out,
she whispers, and her mouth is so close to my ear, if you couldn't hear her, you'd think she was telling me a secret. I grab my bag and step into the cold. The freezing air on my legs almost paralyzes me. The second I'm out of the car, Lindsay guns it, peeling away with the door still swinging open. I start walking in the leaf and trash-filled ditch that runs next to the road. My fingers and toes go numb almost instantly, and I stomp my feet on the frost-covered leaves to keep the blood flowing. It takes a minute for the long line of traffic to begin to unwind, and horns are still honking away, the sound like the fading wail of a passing train. A blue Toyota pulls up next to me. A woman leans out, gray-haired, probably in her 60s, and shakes her head.
Crazy girl,
she says, frowning at me. For a moment, I just stand there, but as the car starts to pull away, I remember that it doesn't matter. None of it matters. So I throw up my middle finger, hoping she sees. All the way to school, I repeat it again. It doesn't matter. None of it matters, until the words themselves lose meaning. Here's one of the things I learned that morning. If you cross a line and nothing happens, the line loses meaning. It's like that old riddle about a tree falling in a forest and whether it makes a sound if there's no one around to hear it. You keep drawing a line farther and farther away, crossing it every time. That's how people end up stepping off the edge of the earth. You'd be surprised at how easy it is to bust out of orbit, to spin out to a place where no one can touch you, to lose yourself, to get lost. Or maybe you wouldn't be surprised. Maybe some of you already know. To those people, I can only say, I'm sorry. I skip my first four periods just because I can, and spend a couple of hours walking the halls with no real goal or destination. I almost hope someone will stop me, a teacher or Ms. Winters or a teacher's aide or someone, and ask what I'm doing, even accuse me point blank of cutting and send me to the principal's office. Fighting with Lindsay left me unsatisfied, and I still feel a vague but pressing desire to do something. Most of the teachers just nod or smile, though, or give me a half wave. They have no way of knowing my schedule, no way of knowing whether I have a free period or whether class was canceled, and I'm disappointed by how easy it is to break the rules. When I walk into Mr. Daimler's class, I deliberately don't look at him, but I can feel his eyes on me, and after I slide into my desk, he comes straight over.